Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones, a world tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy. Are you going to do that voice every week now?
Have I had a streak of it going?
You have.
Okay, I won't anymore. I'm just excited to be alive. Excited to next week go to Portland and Seattle.
Me too.
In the PNW, as everyone there refers to it, the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I am aware of the Pacific Northwest, but I've never heard PNW.
You think they already got their Halloween decorations up?
Why? Why would? Do you think Halloween hits the West Coast first?
I just don't know. You're starting to see them spread up around here. I don't know if they get deeper into it. It's going to be a little cooler there, which I'm kind of looking forward to. I'm kind of thinking that maybe, maybe they'll have some Halloween decorations.
You think it's kind of a spooky part of the country.
It's super spooky.
Twin Peaks is from that area, and obviously Twilight.
And Erie, Indiana.
That's Indiana.
We were talking about Seattle and how did we get there? Talking about Seattle, and then we were thinking about we like to do locally themed shows, which we are not going to do this time for reasons that will become evident. And we're talking about Seattle, and we're talking about Grey's Anatomy. It's like, is there something there with the Grey's Anatomy connection?
Right. So Grey's Anatomy, the TV show,
right?
Which takes its name from Grey's Anatomy. The book, which the gray is spelled different.
I feel like
you're curious.
I am. So I'm very curious. I feel like I'm not to impugn the quality of the show. I've never watched it really. I feel like every time I see that show still on, I'm like, wow, that show is still on, huh?
I watched it for a while and then I kind of lost interest because for me, the medicine was the more interesting part of all those medical shows. And
right.
When you spend so much time on romantic drama, just not my thing.
It has that show has been on for 14 seasons. Jeez. 317 episodes. Are you kidding me?
I also find those shows way more interesting when they're in residency and stuff. Mm-hmm. And once they're attendings, I don't know. Less intriguing. But yeah. I say that as a boring attending myself.
But where did this get us?
So anyway, I started looking into the history of the book Grey's Anatomy.
The book the show is based on.
Yes. Based on in title only, let me say. not based on.
Adapted from.
And it started to get me thinking about the history of anatomical drawings, of medical illustrations. The artwork of drawing bodies, I guess.
Okay.
Because that was an important skill that was developed over time that kind of evolved alongside art in order for us to study and understand the human body.
Okay.
Right? I mean, how else do you communicate what's inside a body unless you have pictures of it?
No, we don't. We don't have photos for sure. Not at that time.
Well, no, not at the in ancient history. You're right.
I'm saying, photography. I'm making the point that we had to start with probably cave drawings and stuff of this is a butt. In case you see one of these between the legs and the stomach, here's what you're working with. It's a butt. Why does it have a hole? Why does it have a crack? We don't know. We plan to write some good jokes about it here in the next few millennia, but we're still in the dark on butts.
Well, we know they're called butts.
Good. Jerry has positioned himself on a rock. He calls it sitting. Is this the purpose of butts? We do not know.
So we've done a whole episode.
Sitting may be the devil. Might be cursed. You might be cursed because Jerry said his legs started to tingle with magic after he sat. He did past tense. Oh, by the way, he invented past tense too, and invented the past tense of sitting, which is sat, the gerund. What did I say?
His legs are tingling, so obviously, let's try some bloodletting.
Let's let some of the blood out. There's too much blood for sitting.
That seems like the first treatment. Okay, so we've talked about the history of dissection, and I'm going to go into that just a little. We've done a whole episode about it, so I don't want to belabor the point. But obviously, before we could draw pictures of the inside of the human body, we had to see it. The word anatomy, by the way, dates back to the ancient Greek for cutting up or taking apart. Mm. So anatomy, while it describes, you know, it is our anatomy. We're talking about the thing that is our body and the stuff inside it. Cutting it up or taking apart and looking at it is intrinsic to the word itself. Hippocrates was not big on dissection. It just wasn't really done back at that time. The idea of cutting into the human body was, first of all, kind of taboo. And secondly, it was thought to be dangerous. Mm. Even before the concept of what an infection was, mm-hmm. the idea of a dead body was, again, and I'm using the word infected, they would not have used that exact word because they didn't know about germs yet, right? But there was something contaminated about the body, and to cut into it would contaminate you as well. So you wouldn't have been doing a lot of dissections back in that time, but he did make a lot of observations about external parts and accidentally viewed internal parts through mm-hmm. wounds and things like that. And but he didn't do drawings, at least that I could find anywhere, based on that. And the other thing, too, as I started to think about, like, but why wasn't anybody drawing anything? Well, also, it would be unlikely that some of that stuff would exist still. I mean, it's not as easy to copy as text.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so and that's part of this story as well. The first dissection was probably done by Herophilus in Alexandria in the 3rd century BCE with the help of his assistant, Erastratus. Erastratus.
I'm assuming this is a post-mortem.
Yes.
To use a fancy term.
Yes.
The doctors do.
I guess autopsy, if you will, but dissection as well. I mean, I think you could use those words at this time interchangeably, but it's really, you have different purposes, you know?
Right. For, yes.
Dissection's
educational mm-hmm. about, the in body. General.
Yeah.
Autopsy's specific to learning about the victim.
Right.
Of the perp. As they say. Now, again, I'm getting into crime.
Well, it doesn't have to be a crime. Like, well, or just cause of
most
death.
Most of the ones I've seen on TV are crimes.
Well, sure. The ones you've seen on TV. You know those are also fake, right?
What do you got next?
Except for one time, but we'll get into that.
Whoa.
He was celebrated by the scientific community for doing this dissection, and he was given the title the Father of Anatomy because he was the first one to be like, hey.
I'll vote that's God, but okay. God, the Holy Father of God of Abraham.
That's your opinion.
Okay.
That's your opinion. Everybody sees that differently. From his descriptions, we got a better understanding of things like veins and arteries. He described reproductive organs. He described the pancreas. He wrote a lot about the process of childbirth. However, it was later reported that he performed like 600 vivisections, so some of them like partial dissections on prisoners, maybe some while they were still alive.
Oh no.
So I don't think there were as many rules at that time,
if any,
about humane treatment of people, even if they were prisoners or even if they were sentenced to death. I think that, and you'll see this kind of...
This dude's going to beef it anyway.
Well, you see this theme where it's like, well, they've been sentenced to death, so we may as well. And that's
like,
not...
Like, that's wild. That's I wish I'd been there because I'd been like, my dude, we're all sentenced to death. Like, can we not, please?
At the school there in Alexandria, you see some of the first anatomical drawings that were created based on these dissections. So he created this culture that you could dissect a human body. That after, I mean, hopefully after, but maybe sometimes before someone had died, it was acceptable to, you know, open up their body and take a look to try to learn more about the human body with the goal that we could take this information and do something helpful with it someday, right? But you couldn't easily reproduce any of these drawings. You would have had to draw them again if you wanted to, you know, put them in a book and give them to somebody.
Sure.
So obviously that was a whole other
challenge. It's a problem with all knowledge, exchange of knowledge at this point, right? Like if you lose the original, that's it.
Yeah, because you got to write it again because we don't have a printing press. So, yeah.
Spoilers. Sheesh.
I think everybody knows that in the 3rd century BCE, we didn't have the printing press.
And now I just see you're spoiling the printing press is going to get invented. I imagine that being a big milestone for this. Some people may not know. They don't want to ruin it for everybody. Like, some people may not
some
know.
Some people might not know.
Some people may not know. That was one of like, those. So there might be some people who are like, how are they going to solve this?
That was one of those things that I feel like they taught me in history class, though. And I remember thinking, why do I need to know that this happened? I mean, like, obviously I'm aware. And now we have computers, so it doesn't matter. But
yeah, that's weird. Okay.
I mean, you know, like, didn't everybody learn that? And then the printing press.
Yeah, but, like, you should know. Oh, my God, Sydney. I'm not going to. You're turning into a real Justin on this, and I need you to keep moving.
Okay. So this put an end to dissections for a while because of some of the issues surrounding possible live dissection of human beings. And then there were some that created even more cultural taboos around the processes of anatomical dissection. And so it wasn't done for a while after that. Galen, who we trust a lot of his medical writings and drawings and descriptions of the human body and things, was basically using all of his predecessor's stuff to create all of that. Mm-hmm. He wasn't doing these dissections himself. He was basing it on what other people had said and drawn and described. He was looking at wounds of gladiators. He a lot of what he derived about the human body was just from looking at open wounds from gladiators. Some of it
was crafty, though. I gotta give it up. They got, you know,
a way to get a peek inside.
Yeah, sure. Hey, come here. That's like this. That's like the extreme version of the post sports game interviews, like, hey, champ, come on over if you could just for 1 second. Yeah, if I could just bother you for 1 second. How do you feel when out there? I just want to, if I could just duck my head inside this spear wound.
Is that a lion? Did a lion do that?
We all really gave it our all. And
so he would also dissect monkeys. And there was a lot of assumption made that any primate anatomy would do, kind of, when we're describing human anatomy.
I mean, starting from the point we were starting at, it's not completely wrong, right?
He definitely got stuff wrong. And this was a big, I don't want to say this was a big problem, like I'm hating on Galen, but the reason this became such a big problem is because he was considered the authority. So as time goes on and actual dissections start to take place again, and you're holding up these images of what we find in actual human bodies versus these images that Galen created based on word of mouth and monkeys, people would actually say, well, I guess it's just that this body is wrong because it couldn't be that Galen was wrong. I mean, the you would look at the evidence before your eyes and still say, well, the cadaver must be wrong. It's got to be Galen couldn't have been wrong.
That's humans for you.
It wasn't until the Middle Ages that dissections really started up again. And then you see more drawings produced from that. There were some figures that were doing public dissections at this time, which obviously would help with spreading this information as well and furthering the study. The first one was like Mondino de Luzzi at the University of Bologna did the first like live dissection that people could watch. And this, again, these things are important because then you can study anatomy. It makes it okay to some extent,
right?
Or at least you can justify it. Well, that other guy did it. Most of the anatomical drawings of this period of the Middle Ages are kind of simple, almost like crude drawings. If you look at these, and we should post some of these to our Facebook page so people can kind of see what I'm talking about. They largely exist to just show like a spatial relationship between really major organs and structures. So like, here's a crude outline, like a 2D flat outline of a human body, and like something that represents a heart and mm-hmm. something that represents a lung, and here's some intestine, that kind of thing. Very crude looking drawings for the most part. They're usually pretty humanoid, but sometimes the proportions of the human body are very odd. When they're rendered. Hmm. I mean, and again, these are rendered from life, so it's not like you're guessing. The wound man, do you remember the wound man from the episode where we have the guy with all the with all the like spears and knives and things sticking out of him?
Yeah.
Remember that guy?
The worst superhero ever.
That's kind of a good example of art, like anatomical art from this time. Like, here's this guy who's just kind of standing there awkwardly, and he's got a bunch of like wounds and implements hanging out of his body. This was an anatomical drawing, I guess. There were some really awkward, I found like some squatting figures that just had like a heart and some blood vessels mm-hmm. that vaguely represented the tracks of wear, but nothing was definite. It wasn't like this blood vessel or that one. It was just like, here's some random lines, some red lines and some blue lines. There you go. Giacomo Berengario da Carpi was a famous doctor and anatomist from the 1400s who actually dissected and illustrated a text. He had made a name for himself pretending to treat syphilis with mercury. He wasn't very successful, but he did make a lot of money and became kind of famous.
Nice.
As was the fashion. And then he spent a lot of time on this text called Anatomia Carpi. And these drawings are still somewhat simple. In a lot of cases, but there are some actual organs depicted. There's some actual close up on like, here is an actual organ, and like, I'm trying to draw the structure of it, not just some vague blob. Like, this is what it might look like. Mm-hmm. The human figures are really interesting, and you'll see this repeated for quite a while. And this is probably something people have looked at through art, like in if you've ever stumbled across these drawings and never really considered. The figures are, one, they're very idealized. They look like perfect. They're like godly mm-hmm. specimens of humanity. Mm-hmm. Not, and I don't just mean like from a physical ideal, whatever you consider the physical quote unquote ideal to be. I mean, like, they look saintly. They might have like beams of light radiating from their body. there are a lot of like naked men, like muscular men, like posing with like beams of light around them, and their hands are triumphantly outstretched as they open up their like skin to reveal their perfect pectorals and their perfect abdominal muscles. That's underneath. Rad. Yeah.
Well, you might as well have a little fun.
And they look, and they're alive. Like they're pictures of live people, like revealing their organs.
Like Slim Goodbody.
Yes. Exactly. It's Slim Goodbody. No. But some of the skeletons, because there are skeleton drawings too, but they're like frozen in like dance-like poses. They look very nice. They're like, hello, I'm a skeleton. Look at this. Look at my bones. There are some people who are just standing there like carelessly like leaning on an axe and pointing with like part of their like they're all naked, but then like sometimes you're seen underneath as well, like the right. musculature or whatever. There are a lot of female figures that are depicted as like draped dramatically over chairs, like I almost imagine they're not on fainting couches, but that was like the thing that reminded
basically
me, like they're like draped and they always like, and this is in all the figures, like somewhere their skin is just kind of splayed open to reveal what's underneath as if that has just naturally happened. Some of them are like dancing with scarves and then their abdominal cavity happens to be open.
I just realized, is Slim Goodbody a touchstone that the people of today are familiar with? Because that might have seemed like a weird thing for me to say. Slim Goodbody, was he like, is he still relevant, or is that just our childhood?
I don't think he's still relevant, but I think there are probably people our age who remember the character Slim Goodbody.
Unless he's listening, in which case... You are still relevant, Mr. Goodbody. Wow. And wow, can I say, what an honor it is to look, slimgoodbody.com. He's still doing it. He's still doing the dang thing. He's out there on his grind. Okay, sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt again for the millionth time.
This is the same era as Da Vinci, by the way. Okay. And I think you could see some of this echoed in his human figures, you know, the anatomical drawings that Da Vinci did, which are these beautiful depictions of the human form. Also trying to be exact and show what is what, right? Mm-hmm. Like what's underneath all the bumps? That's what artists want to know sometimes. What's underneath all those bumps so I can draw them better? But so that, but also they're very beautiful as well. Versalius comes along at this point, and this was for a long time. This was kind of like the basis of a lot of anatomical knowledge. It was 1543. Andreas Versalius publishes De Humani Corporis Fabrica Libri Septem, which means on the fabric of the human body in 7 books. So a lot of stuff about the human body. He did dissections. He employed a lot of different artists to render what he was seeing so that he could actually have somebody who was very talented draw the stuff. He did the dissection and then people watched it and drew it.
That seems smarter. Like, what are the odds you're going to be like a good dissector and a good drawer too? It seems low.
That's actually true. You'll find that a lot. The cover showed Versalius. This is really cool. So one of Versalius's goals was to contradict Galen, like maybe even to go picture for picture to tell everybody, like, look, Galen was not right about everything. And I'm going to show you exactly why. So the cover of this tome is Versalius doing a dissection on a convicted criminal who I think is still alive. Like they've been sentenced to death. And there are all these people around him watching him. And there's like a skeleton hovering over, I guess, to creep everybody out or remind everyone of the specter of death. And then there's Galen in one corner watching and Aristotle in the other corner watching him as he does this dissection. So Versalius, I think, maybe thought a lot of himself is what I'm saying. So at this point, you have a lot of artistic advances. So like rendering and perspective. Perspective is a big deal if you think about it. The idea of perspective and art, as that becomes a thing, that really influenced the way that we could see a human body and understand proportions a lot better. And then you also start to see the use of woodcuts to reprint the images.
Okay.
So that made this book really special because you could, and can you imagine the detail that would take to do a woodcut
of
like the vasculature or something and then reprint that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So you had these very beautiful detailed drawings and then on the woodcut and then reprinted. And he challenged a lot of Galen's false beliefs. There's still, by the way, 700 copies of this book that you can find.
I'll grab one.
There is one in Brown University's John Hay Library, which is bound in human skin.
Fun.
I think we've talked about that before.
We did, because they have some at the Mutter. Mm-hmm. They have some human skin books.
Yep. So there is one of those. The anatomical art that followed of the 17th and 18th century was just, it kind of was expanding on this. More lifelike details, obviously perspective and everything. They also would add things like sometimes like a sheet draped over a body or like a fly on the body to make it really like, bam.
Super spooky.
Yeah.
For
like, look, this looks really real.
Provided for scale.
You could also use copper plates to start. They started using some copper plates to like reprint the images. You also saw like the rise of the anatomical museum at this point with like you could walk into a spooky room with a bunch of shelves with organs and jars and things like that.
Well, we haven't come that far from that.
The ones of the early 1800s have sometimes done away with like the backgrounds because like all these drawings that I'm talking about, you can look at them. They all have like rolling hills and trees and stuff behind these figures. Mm-hmm. So they start to do away with that because like, why do you need that?
Right.
You're just looking at the body. You don't need that. But they were still these idealized human figures. They weren't really necessarily easy to follow. A lot of it was just blocks of text next to a picture. And they would describe everything next to the picture. But like labels weren't necessarily used.
Huh, interesting.
So obviously we've made a lot of progress, but we're not where we need to be yet.
Right. How do we get there?
Well, I'm going to tell you that, Justin. But first, let's go to the billing department.
Let's go. The medicines that escalate macabre
for the mouth. So there's a lot of stuff that medical TV shows can get wrong. But I know one of the most disappointing things for me when I started practicing is how uncomfortable conventional scrubs can be. They don't necessarily fit all body shapes really well, and they're scratchy. And that's until I found Figs. So our shifts in the hospital can be really long or in the office, and you need scrubs that feel good, that fit you well, and they're going to last all day long. Figs make scrubs for the medical professionals of today. They're not like a paper bag. They're not itchy. They feel great. They're so soft and comfortable. They're form-fitting. They're made for the kind of work that we actually do, where we're up and down, we're on our feet. Sometimes I'm sitting on the exam room floor checking out somebody's toenails, and I need to be comfortable while I'm doing it. They're antimicrobial, so you know that you're going to be protected. You can wash them every time you wear them, which is super important. I wash my scrubs, obviously, every day that I wear them. And they look good, so you can look like those cute TV docs and nurses that that made us go into medicine in the first place. You can check out tops like the Katarina and the Cade pants. It's an easy, relaxed fit, and then so many cargo pockets, which I can tell you that's the main thing we need, are pockets for our pens, pockets for our notebooks, pockets for my Narcan, pockets for everything. I love Figs. They are so comfortable. And with the work that I do, kind of unconventional out in the street medicine, I need something that feels good all day long. With back to school season upon us, it's the perfect time to stock up with some fresh outfits for the year. And Figs just dropped a brand new collection of limited edition styles and accessories. If you're in healthcare or if you're shopping for someone who is, you can get 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com. Code FIGSRX, FIGSRX.
I have really enjoyed experimenting with fashion thanks to Quince. Now, I know that that sounds wild coming from me, Justin McElroy, a podcaster. Why, Justin, are you even wearing clothes? I hear you. But when I want to try a new look, what I love about Quince is they have a lot of different clothing items that are at a great price and are really well made. So if you want to try something, you're not sure if it's like, is this going to be the right fit for me? I don't know. Try it out with Quince. There's craftsmanship that you see in every detail of these clothes. I've bought several, like a pair of shorts I love, a pair of pants I wear literally every day. I mean, nearly every day, not literally every day. You know what I mean? Because there's some days you're just like, you can't. But I've been so happy with the pieces that we have gotten from Quince. And also there's a really wide variety of stuff. You know, there's silk tops, skirts for dressing up, denim for everyday wear. I don't mention a lot of the specific items because honestly, you shouldn't trust me about that part of it if it's outside my specific range of clothes for my body. But I will say this, for my body, Quince does right. It sounds weird now that I say it like that. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/sawbones for free shipping on your order. 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/sawbones to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/sawbones. Now, Sid, I think we are about to finally make a little progress here.
That's well, and to be fair, Justin, we had made progress. We
make
definitely
a little more progress.
If you
here.
Look at the if you look from like old texts where there are no pictures to like the realization we need some pictures and here are some like crude human figures with some vague organs inside to like some beautiful but disturbing images of live humans dancing around with their organs popping out across the beautiful Greek countryside or wherever they were. and then finally we have like some actual anatomical drawings and figures. This brings us to Grey's Anatomy. Not the TV show.
Okay.
No. The one with the A. Grey. Just with an A.
Got it.
Right. So
we won't be talking much about the TV show, I would think.
We've already talked about it plenty.
A good amount.
So I had always assumed that Grey's Anatomy was completely made by whoever Grey was.
Got his name right on there. Right? Henry Grey, right?
Yes, Henry Grey.
I don't know why I knew that. That's weird. I didn't look at the notes. I know it seems like I would have looked at the notes. I didn't.
I've talked about it.
Oh, I've listened. Oh, wow.
That's nice.
Cool.
So,
good husband.
Henry Grey, Dr. Henry Grey, was a young and up-and-coming anatomist at St. George's. He was kind of a well-to-do, upper-class guy. He had a lot of financial support. He had a lot of charisma. He was well-liked. He was determined. He was out to make a name for himself and do whatever it took to be something memorable, to leave a legacy, right? Okay. And he dressed really well and people liked him. And it's important that you kind of get who this guy is. He had recently become a fellow of the Royal Society, which was a big deal. That was not necessarily something that everybody could be. And he had presented papers and things in front of his fellows. And,
yeah, love that.
And was very well respected. And he did have a lot of skill as an anatomist. I don't mean to insinuate that he wasn't talented, but he was talented and he knew it.
Gotcha.
How about that?
I got you. Wink.
He had been lauded recently for an excellent treatise on the spleen. There was something called the Astley Cooper Prize, which was awarded every year to one of the I don't even necessarily think you had to be a fellow. It was just one of the doctors. Mm-hmm. And they would give you like a topic, like everybody has to do a treatise on this. And whoever does the best one gets this prize. And it was like £300 or something. And so they were all challenged to do something on the spleen. And he wrote a very good treatise on the spleen, and his text was very good, but he needed help with the drawings. That wasn't necessarily his skill set. He could do them, but he wanted somebody who was really good. And he had heard of a younger anatomist who was still in training, who was making some money on the side, doing some drawings, doing some illustrations for various other doctors and professors. And he reached out to him, and his name was Dr. Henry Van Dyke Carter. Also Henry.
Okay. Easy to remember.
Yeah. So he talked to Dr. Carter and he said, you know, I would really like you to do the illustrations for this thing I'm doing on the spleen. And if you look back through, the cool thing is Dr. Carter kept a huge diary through most of his life about all of his daily ins and outs, everything that happened to him. So you can really, you get to know this guy a lot easier. I've been reading a book about it, The Anatomist, and you really get to a feel for who he was a lot easier. He was very self-conscious. He was very insecure. His family wasn't exactly thrilled with what he was doing with his life. They didn't necessarily think he was going to be successful. He had a very strong religious upbringing and a very strong faith. And he was constantly doubting whether or not he was kind of fulfilling his duties on earth, kind of being the best Henry he could be.
Got it.
So this guy who's like riddled with self-esteem issues, who's desperate to succeed, he totally idolizes Henry Gray, thinks he's just amazing, and he wants to be just like him because he buys into everything that Henry Gray appears to be. So when he asks him, will you do some illustrations for my spleen treatise, he's like, yes, for sure,
love to draw a spleen.
So he does it.
Probably is like kind of round, looks like a bean, if I had to guess.
Yeah, but I bet his drawings were probably better than that.
I know. I'm just kind of guessing what a spleen probably looks like. Kind of round.
You just think most organs are kind of round and look like a bean.
Basically, yes.
So the kidneys look way more like beans, but anyway.
Well, there is a bean named after him, Sid, so I didn't assume. I forgot about that. Whole bean after him. The kidney looks more like a bean? You're trying to drop knowledge on me?
They must be so honored that they have a whole bean named after them.
A whole bean? Wow. Wow.
All we do is...
People are really going to remember the name kidney now.
All we do is filter all the toxins from your blood and keep you alive, but I'm glad we got a bean.
I'm going to show my parents the liver that I really made it. The kidney's dad is the liver.
There's no liver bean.
No, the liver is the kidney's dad.
Oh, okay, no, that's not.
The liver gave birth to kidneys. It is. Look it up in your book.
Anyway, they nabbed the Astley Cooper Prize that year, and this was a huge deal. This was a big
prize.
Boon to his career and reputation.
Like one of the top spleen drawing prizes probably on earth.
So with his money and his potential... And his spleen paper, he decided that he should create an anatomy text that was more accessible to students. He wanted some book that he could write based on his ability as an anatomist, and that all students would be able to afford. He wanted it to be affordable and accessible and kind of the new Bible of human anatomy. So he persuaded Dr. Carter to help him out. And this was hard to do because Gray still has not paid Carter for all the illustrations he did for his spleen paper.
Oh, no.
And so Carter at first is like, I don't know. You kind of owe me money and you promised me some stuff and you didn't really follow through.
Amber.
And this is going to be a lot of work. And he's still working on his career. He's still trying to get all of his licensing and become a physician and work on his own. And he's doing all these drawings because everyone has noticed, like, wow, he's really good at this. We got to keep paying this guy to do this. But he's trying to pursue his own thing. So it takes him a little while, but he finally persuades him. One, because I think Carter, as we know, really, like, admired Gray. And then the other reason is Gray finally promises, like, look, I'll give you £10 a month if you'll do this. Which is probably underpayment by today's standards. Like, if you look at what he created.
And he's not probably not cutting him in on royalties, I assume.
No. No. But he did need money to survive, and so he was willing to take it. So £10 a month he took to start drawing the illustrations for this book. And Gray worked on the text. Carter's illustrations, of course, if you look at Gray's anatomy, and you can find images from this everywhere, you can buy the book. I own a copy.
It's pretty heavy.
Yes, it's huge. Most in medicine probably own a copy. Now, I don't know how practical it is nowadays. Because it's huge.
You bought it when you're in med school. Mm-hmm. Like, it seemed like you had to have it.
Well, you don't. I didn't necessarily need it for med school, but it's just it feels like the thing you're supposed to have.
Yeah, right. I get it.
But he, his illustrations are beautiful. They have the shadowing and just the detail. And I mean, they're really elegant, beautiful, exact drawings, that were probably unmatched at that point. But the other thing that he did was that he labeled the structures. Like, sometimes the words even, like, wind around with the structure they're following and curve. And this was hugely helpful as a student of anatomy, I can tell you, to have the names on the pictures as opposed to trying to read a big block of text and then find what structure they're referencing.
Yeah,
like, this goes inferior to this and goes lateral to this, and just put the name on it.
Yeah.
Gray's text was also really great, though. Like, it was really easy to follow and very descriptive and made a lot of sense, and just, like, it was a very logical progression of thought. So I don't want to undermine Gray. He did a lot of hard work on this, and his skill was definitely felt. But Carter's illustrations are equally important, I think, to the understanding of anatomy. Now, at one point during this process, Gray got asked by, like, a rich guy to come hang out on his yacht for 6 months and be his personal doctor. And Gray took off for a while Carter stayed at home working hard on his illustrations and then also trying to, you know, pursue his career.
Yeah.
But eventually they finished it and they published it. There was a lot of quibbling over the cover page, like the title page, because they had the name of the book, which Gray had already decided was Gray's Anatomy.
Right.
And they had Henry Gray. And then they have, and you can find this page. You can look up this original page if you want to see the proof, because it's been uncovered and like you can see where Henry Gray went. Where Henry Van Dyke Carter's name was listed, and drew through it and said that he wanted the text to be smaller and also eliminated one of his titles so he wouldn't sound as impressive.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So he went and, like, tried to physically minimize the contributions of Carter. Like, you can find this where he has struck through and it's very clear. Like, this is my book. I know he did some pictures, but this is my book.
That's so messed up.
Carter went on to do other things with his life. After he finished all of his training and he had achieved all of his titles and his credentials and licensing and everything, he actually went to India and he worked on leprosy for a long time, wrote some really groundbreaking papers describing leprosy and what caused it and the process of it and all that kind of stuff. So he did a lot of stuff with his life after that. Gray ended up essentially taking all the credit. To this day, if you had asked me who did Gray's Anatomy, I would have thought it was like a joke. Like, well, I mean,
Gray
yeah. did it. I've never heard of Henry Van Dyke Carter until I started researching this. And then his name kind of rung a bell with the leprosy stuff, but I certainly didn't know that he was the one who drew all the pictures in Gray's Anatomy, because Henry Gray kind of took all the credit. It got bigger over time because it was supposed to be like the end-all be-all of human anatomy was mm-hmm. this book. So at one point it was over 2,000 pages at its largest, because the more we learned, the more we added to it, right? Each edition right. got bigger and bigger and bigger. It has been kind of culled to make it a little more accessible, but I think it's still like 1,500 pages.
A little lighter.
Yeah. So it's still pretty dense. The quality of the art is still amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's still unmatched for its time. Most students nowadays probably use Dr. Frank Netter's Atlas of Human Anatomy. I know that was the thing for me in medical school. Everybody had their Netter. And the Netter Atlas is, it's really easy to use. It's smaller, of course. It's not a giant.
Is it probably maybe on a tablet now?
Well, really I'm sure you can do that, but I used a book. Okay. I'm sure you can do that, but I mean, I went to, you know, it's been a while.
Back in the old days.
Anyway, I used a book. It was published in 1989. He called it his personal Sistine Chapel. Hmm. It's kind of a cool guy. Dr. Frank Netter.
Personal Sistine Chapel be said?
Something with podcasts, right?
Yeah, probably. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Maybe it's this episode. I don't know.
He just a little plug for Dr. Frank Netter. Not only did he make this Atlas of Anatomy, which like all med students know the name Netter because they probably have a Netter. He also like spent some of his time devoted to like fighting fake medicine.
Netter.
Cool dude. Anyway, that book was a little easier to follow. And there's color illustrations, which I think help a little bit. I thought I would throw in one final thing as I'm thinking about like the progression of anatomical drawings, because now you can find a ton of different atlases, which are very detailed, exact drawings in different parts of the human body, and some that just focus on the brain or whatever. You can also, if you take, obviously, if you go to medical school or if you are someone in the medical profession, you'll probably do dissecting, which makes it easier to understand. And you can also find prosections, which are actually like pre-dissected parts slices that you can look at.
Yeah.
I did some. I actually made some prosections I was in medical school. But I thought I would tack on to that the Body Worlds exhibit.
Oh, yeah, I guess for sure. It's like the 3D version of what we're talking about.
That's right. So Gunther van Hagens produced the Body Worlds exhibit, which he used a process called plastination, which he actually invented the process to preserve bodies in various forms, like segmented in various ways. So like dissected to various levels and slices, and you can make very thin sections that way and display them.
I'm just remembering when we went to see this exhibit in New York with Riley. Riley was with us, and she was like, probably would have been 6 or 7 at the time. And we kept trying to reassure her that it was all fake. And then we would say something that would hint to her that, like, well, maybe it is, in fact, real. And then we would have to double back, like, no, totally fake. And we kept her in suspense for literal years.
Yeah, it was years that she, and finally she looked at us and went, it was real, right? It was real. It was like, real. You were lying to me, so I wouldn't be freaked out, but it was real.
A few weeks ago, she said.
Do you know, though, that before he made his Body Worlds exhibit, which has some notoriety because there's been some questions about how some of the bodies were obtained, he swears that he got permission for all of them and that he knows where they all came from and that they were all donated.
Right.
But there are other
tough to prove.
There are other similar exhibits that have been called into question. So it's there's obviously some controversy there. But before he did that, he performed the first public autopsy in 170 years in London in 2002 to an audience of 500 people. And it was then later that year shown on Channel 4.
Whoa, creepy.
No idea. There was a dissection and an autopsy was shown on TV.
Are you mad you missed it? Is that where we're at?
No, I'm not mad I missed it. I mean, I've done it, so I don't need to watch it on TV. I'm just,
don't get braggy.
I can't believe that it was on TV. Can you imagine that?
In England, though, they put whatever on England. They put whatever.
Which one is Channel 4? That must be like the serious one, right?
It's not BBC One. It's not BBC Two. It's not BBC Three. That's going to do it for us, folks. Thank you so much for joining us. If you want to see some more great illustrations of bodies, you should pre-order the Sawbones book, bit.ly/the Sawbones book. Taylor Smurl, Sydney's sister and a gifted illustrator, has drawn plenty of bodies for you to feast your eyes on in there. That sounded weird. I didn't mean for it to sound as weird as it did. But bit.ly/ the Sawbones book. We're just a few weeks away, and those pre-orders really do like help, because they all get folded into the first week's sales, and the first week's sales of a book are really, really important. So if you want to support us, please share that link around and pick up a copy to call your local bookstore, pre-order on Amazon, whatever. Just please, thank you. If you're a fan of our show, I think you're really going to love this book. We're really mm-hmm. proud of it. Thanks to the taxpayers for the use of their song Medicines as the intro and outro of our program. And thanks to the Max Fun Network for having us as a part of their extended podcasting family. And thank you to you, most of all, for listening and continuing to support us. But until next week, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.
Hi, I'm Biv.
And I'm Teresa.
And we host When Bev Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting.
Whether you are a parent or just know kids exist in the world, join us each week as we honestly share what it's like to be a parent. And then that's how my day starts.
Yeah.
Come on. I'm so sick of it. When is that going to be over? Like, I want it to stop.
Teresa, you're hurting my ears.
I mean, that's it.
Yeah, no, that's...
I just hate it.
Yeah, I don't blame you. It sucks.
It really sucks.
So join us each week as we judge less, laugh more, and remind you that you are doing a great job.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.